morning, 6 for the warm-up show, 6:30 for the main show, Pacific Pickin' on CITR 101.9 in Vancouver.
Hello, I'm Farah Khan. This is Prof Talk. Last week on Prof Talk, you heard Professor Benjamin Perrin from the Faculty of Law talk about his beginnings and what motivated him to dedicate his life to the protection of human rights. Today, you will hear an incredible and moving speech that he delivered to the BC Human Rights Coalition and the United Nations Association in Canada on the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights last December 10th, 2008.
Every country around the world has a form of human trafficking of some sort. Flipping through the U.S. Department's annual trafficking in persons report, you can hear about the young boys in African nations who are forced to work as fisher boys and have to go and untangle the nets and often drown when they're unable to come up for air in time. There are the very well documented and very well known brothels that exist in Southeast Asia. That's where I first began working on this issue in 2000. Young boys and girls who are bought and sold by family members out of extreme poverty. There is the forced labor, the bricklayers in China, which came out publicly. There are the rubber plantations, which have been exposed in various African countries that have been traced back to some of the tires on the cars that we drive. Modern-day slave labor. We have been looking for all of these different types of foreign, if you want to call them that, forms of trafficking for a very long time in Canada, looking for more shiploads of containers, looking for the types of human trafficking that we've seen in the movies. And what we lost in the last 10 years, in my view, is looking for forms of exploitation and forms of trafficking that were very, very Canadian. And we didn't notice them because we had become so comfortable and used to them. And one of them in particular is something that you would have heard called pimping or child prostitution. The very first conviction, as some of you know, for human trafficking in Canada was of a man in the Brampton, Mississauga area who had recruited young Canadian girls in their teenage years, between 14 and 16. One of them was living in a group home and had fetal alcohol syndrome. He offered her a ride and a chance to get away. Yeah, she took it. And over a period of many, many months, he, through forms of outright flattery and infatuation, built up a relationship and made her fall in love with him. When she decided she didn't want to sleep with men who were paying her boyfriend for money anymore, he threatened to kidnap her brother. He began abusing her. We wouldn't have called this human trafficking very long ago. We'd have said this is child prostitution and pimping. This problem has gone on for so long, no one would ever recognize it as that. But when people around the world come to our country and they look at what we have going on here, they say, how is someone who is directly exploiting another, treating them as a commodity in your country through that form of exploitation, any different from all of the other scenarios around the world where you have a third person who is controlling another for the purposes of exploiting them? That is exactly the same kind of pattern we see internationally, but we ignored it for a long time. Things have only started to change really in the last 2 to 3 years. It was only a crime to be trafficking in Canadians since November of 2005. That's it. Those were not crimes before. They were separate crimes. They would qualify as assault or prostitution, crimes which on their own didn't reflect the true gravity of what's going on, which is the control and the exploitation over a very long period of time and a systematic human rights violation. That is very different, and we're only starting to recognize it. The research that that our team at the University of British Columbia is doing is trying to account for the various forms of Canada's role in human trafficking. So it's similar to the types of research that's being done in the parliamentary committees that are hearing evidence. We've been traveling across the country interviewing people who've directly worked with victims. And you're starting to see in Canada moving beyond outrage into more focused action. It's not enough for us to be enraged or upset when we hear about human trafficking. We need to find our own particular piece that we can work on and make a difference in that way. So where I sit right now at a university is attempting to try to map this out and bring people together who are not currently sharing information with each other. It might surprise you to know that lead government agencies at the federal level who work on this issue as their day job until very recently were not keeping each other very well informed about how the progress was moving forward on this. It took an access to information request that we filed for the big fee of $5 to find out how many victims of foreign trafficking had received the support of the Immigration Department. And those statistics, which we released in the end of October at a conference held by the BC Office to Combat Trafficking, confirmed that the problem of foreign trafficking, both labor and sex exploitation related, is happening in Canada. We were able to not just talk about Asia and Europe, but get to the list of four top source countries for Canada. So it's, again, something like this couldn't have happened a year or two ago. So we're at a really pivotal point in our history where we have finally got a criminal law in place, we finally have some protective services in place for foreign victims, and a BC government office which is coordinating and preparing to coordinate services for others who may come forward, and a growing awareness of the problem. What we've seen in other countries that got on this problem sooner, for example, in the United States, who has actually been one of the things they have done globally, a world leader in dealing with the issue of human trafficking, they created their criminal offenses in 2000. They brought in victim protection around that time period. They have some issues, of course, as every country does. But what you see when you look at how they implemented it is a very few number of cases in the first year, both in terms of prosecutions and victim protection. But then they started to grow as awareness began to be built. Resources got implemented beyond simply the words on paper. And you see a steady increase of cases until they reach a fairly stable point, and you see consistent levels, more or less, of trafficking prosecutions and a very sophisticated level of knowledge. We're beginning slowly to get to the point in Canada of not just talking about traffickers, but to the point of being able to name names, to know which organizations and street gangs are involved. And law enforcement has only begun to put the pieces together. So we're at a key point in time. One of the pieces of the research which I said I want to focus on now in the next 10 minutes or so is the issue of demand. This has not been on the table as a part of this program to address human trafficking internationally until very recently. Most people were very happy to talk about the big bad traffickers, but they weren't as quick to admit that this problem only existed because of the demand in their own countries by Canadians, men and women, for both the cheap products, which we don't bother to ask questions about, or the men who are paying for sex in our cities today. Studies have shown that Canadian men who are purchasing sex do not care and cannot discriminate or know the difference between paying for sex with someone who may be an independent agent, someone who is under the control of another person, or someone who is fully forced. That's what the research is finding. Okay, so they don't know and they don't care. That girl I told you about who was the 14-year-old girl with fetal alcohol syndrome, the first victim of human trafficking whose prosecution of her trafficker succeeded, she was being sold on the internet on Craigslist. And when men showed up, they didn't see how young she was and turn away or ask about her very, very intimidating boyfriend who was there. They simply proceeded with what for them was a commercial transaction, like buying a used lawnmower on the website. They just didn't care. So demand. It's an issue here in Canada, but it is also an issue here internationally. Canada has a law, as you've heard, to prosecute Canadians for traveling overseas and sexually exploiting or abusing children. The way that our law works, which has been in place since 1997, so almost 12 years now, is that it identifies a list of crimes, which are crimes in Canada, so sexual exploitation of a minor, for example, child prostitution, for example, and simply says they apply around the world. If you're a Canadian citizen, no matter where you are, if you commit these offenses against children, you can be held liable in a Canadian court. Now, that was released with much fanfare. It was a big deal. It was a big commitment. We all came back from a conference in 1996 saying we were going to, you know, join the rest of the world. The Stockholm Conference, the first World Congress against sexual exploitation of children. I just came back from the third World Congress against sexual exploitation of children in Brazil last month. And guess what? People remember that we made that commitment to prosecute our own nationals. NGOs know that Canadians are engaging in this behavior and abusing children. They are being required, and I'll be very frank here, to clean up the mess that Canadian offenders are making around the world. These are poor countries. We're forcing them to clean up the trauma and harm that Canadian men have visited upon very vulnerable boys and girls in these countries. The Cambodian head of ECPAT, ECPAT Cambodia, which is a major international organization combating child sexual exploitation, was beside himself when he talked to me, when he asked me. He said, I just don't get it. Your country is viewed so favorably around the world. Everyone talks about how wonderful Canada is. How can you let these men, who are often convicted sex offenders, get a Canadian passport, travel to my country, abuse these children, often bribe their way out, and if there's any whiff of them being investigated, they go to the next country? How is it that we're supposed to bear the burden of that? And the answers that we have are not very good. The accidental prosecutions are the way that we have so far succeeded to get a small handful of Canadian men convicted under this law. Okay. This is very, very different from what other countries like Australia and the United States do, which is to place their liaison officers from a lead law enforcement agency in the field to actually contact local groups like ECPAT Cambodia and say, just so you know, our country has a law against this. If ever you have a case of someone who has come forward from one of the children you're helping, contact us. We will come and meet with you. We will take a statement from that child, and we will see if we can lay a prosecution. Okay. Our approach is to do what's been to, you know, create some posters. We've, you know, done that. That's true. It's a very nice poster, I have to say. I'm being very sarcastic because it is a real sore spot for me. That for such a long period of time, we have known that this was happening, and we still have not taken any major steps. Imagine what more could be done if we proactively began enforcing our law. If we did that, we might see some statistics along the lines of what the Americans and the Australians are doing. Between 2003 and 2008, the U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement Agency, ICE, made 67 arrests and secured 47 convictions in that five-year period. We had one. Okay. In Australia, between 1995 and 2007, the Australian Federal Police, who have officers stationed in child sex tourism hotspots, conducted 158 investigations. That resulted in 28 charges and 19 convictions. We have a lot more to do. The world has noticed. We were hiding behind our very good words for a long time, but we have been found out. I have to tell you, it worked for a while, but we've been found out. So this is what the latest U.S. State Department report did. It criticized Canada for not prosecuting or investigating allegations of child sex crimes against its nationals. It called on us to increase our efforts to investigate and prosecute Canadians suspected of committing child sex tourism crimes abroad. The money Canadian men are paying in developing countries, and it's a short list, we know which these countries are, is fueling human trafficking. It creates a demand, a disproportionate demand. Local men are paying in local currency. Cambodian men are paying to abuse these children as well, absolutely. But when a Canadian man goes over there with hard currency, often American dollars, and is paying significantly more to insist for younger girls because they're worried about STDs and want to have unprotected sex with these young children, that drives demand. Without that huge influx of Canadian bred money, we and our American friends and our European friends would not be making such a big contribution to this problem. The last point I wanted to illustrate for you was what the outcome of this Rio conference was. This is available on my website if anyone is interested off the UBC Law faculty. It's actually open for consultation and comments until the end of the month. That's a great opportunity. If any of you want to give feedback on this draft document, it's one where I would be happy to forward that to the conference organizers. So please take a look at this. It deals with four main issues in particular because the conference is related to children: child prostitution, child pornography, child trafficking, and child sex tourism. And of course, they're highly interrelated. What the Rio Pact draft has in it are some important provisions that I was involved in helping to get into this final document with a number of NGOs. The first is, not surprisingly, calling on countries to designate a lead law enforcement agency to proactively enforce extraterritorial laws related to the sexual exploitation of children and adolescents. 1996 commitments were to create those laws. It's taken us until 2008 to say maybe someone should go about enforcing them. In Canada, this should obviously be the RCMP. The RCMP has liaison officers around the world, including in major child sex tourism hotspots. They work on drug cases, Canadian document identity fraud, all sorts of serious transnational crimes. This needs to be on their mandate to be enforced on a proactive basis. The National Child Exploitation Coordination Center, the NCECC, is the RCMP division that so far has been processing and receiving these tips as they happen to come into them. Organizations in the field are sending these tips to people like myself because they don't know who else to send them to. We're not talking about we think it was a Canadian. The kind of evidence that I have personally received and forwarded to the RCMP in the last 5 years have included photocopies and scanned versions of the passports of these men. How did they get that? Most of these hotels require passports to be provided, and they're very happy to hand them over when they find out what these men have been doing to kids in their hotel establishments. Don't assume that everyone is in on this deal. A lot of corruption happens, but many people are outraged at it. Victim witness statements are also forthcoming. In many cases, computer files have been obtained through local police, and there's all sorts of evidence, which is enough to show me that we need to have Canadian officers involved in gathering evidence because we can't simply rely on this sort of material to result in convictions. The second and more important aspect that we could immediately do, which the Rio Pact calls for, is a very important step that Interpol has taken. Okay. Interpol has been doing more to deal with this issue than Canada in many ways. Some of you know Christopher Paul Neal. This was the man last year who had the swirled photo, also from the Vancouver area, Maple Ridge. He was recently convicted of his second count and sentenced to 6 years in a Thai prison. Interpol was involved heavily in finding him. They have a special program through Interpol for serious violent criminals. It's called the Green Notice System. The way that it works is if someone who is, for example, a convicted murderer wants to travel abroad, our national representative for Interpol is able to send out this green notice to the country where that person is going to travel to let them know this person has been convicted. We're not talking allegations, we're talking convictions in a Canadian court of law. Then it leaves it to this foreign country to decide if they want to admit that person or say, you know, you're not welcome here. We don't want you here. Only recently did Interpol amend their green notice system to allow for convicted child sex offenders to clearly be included in this. So the Rio Pact calls on countries to establish this international travel notification system where individuals with a history of engaging in sexual exploitation of children would have to notify of their travel before leaving in accordance with applicable laws, and then the state where they're purporting to travel to would get to decide how to deal with that. So the world has noticed that we have not been doing our part to address the very clear contribution we are directly making. At a bare minimum, we need to at least not be the ones contributing to the problem. If all Canada was doing was sitting here and minding our own business, that would be one thing. I would still have a problem, and I think most people in the room would think we should still have a moral obligation to do something about it. But we actually are doing more harm than good on the child sex tourism issue today. That is something I can say with a very high degree of confidence, and it needs to change. I saw Canadian men my own age when I was first in Cambodia wearing backpacks with Canadian maple leaves on them, walking through Sphai Pak, which is one of the very well-known child brothel districts just outside of Phnom Penh. And it was one of the most shameful things that I have ever seen in my entire life, because that's the flag that we have told the world should be a sign to welcome us. And when you go somewhere with a Canadian flag, you get greeted and people usually find something nice to say to you. That's why so many Americans wear them on their backpacks. It's true. They do. It is true. Yeah. So certainly we can do more to deal with this issue. If there are any organizations here today who are working with individuals who are, perhaps this talk of human trafficking made you think that these individuals may be exploited by someone else, I would love to talk to you. That's how we do our research. It's not from sitting in an office up there in the woods. It feels very sophisticated to come downtown after having an office in the woods, I have to tell you. But it's by getting on the ground, by directly meeting with the Aboriginal groups that you've heard about, going to their shelters, meeting some of these young women, and the desire to do the same thing here in Vancouver. So please do reach out, and thank you so much for making it part of your time to become educated and informed more than you are before you came here. And I hope something that I've said will trigger something, some sort of action in you, because certainly this group on the panel, you know, we are all getting very, very old. I am growing a lot of gray hair working on this project, and I am still a very young man. So we need your help too. Thank you very much, and thank you to the BC Coalition.
You just heard a speech that Professor Benjamin Perrin from the UBC Faculty of Law delivered last December. When I spoke with Benjamin Perrin last week on Prof Talk, he also talked about his current project on human trafficking in Canada taking place right here at UBC. This project will provide the first comprehensive account of Canada's involvement in human trafficking for sexual exploitation and propose effective policy recommendations to confront this problem.
The first thing that you usually get as advice when you're a young professor is to start working on something that you know a little bit about. So I saw that as an opportunity to begin to do some work that was really lacking. When I was with the Future Group, which is this NGO in Cambodia, we began getting calls from the media about what was Canada doing to deal with human trafficking. We didn't have any good answers. No one knew if Canada was doing anything or to what extent it was a problem. And then these cases began coming up and surfacing, particularly of foreign women who were being taken into the sex trade through debt bondage, forced to stay in it and pay off these inflated debts that they supposedly owed to travel to Canada. And at the end of the day, there was a big black hole as to what happened to these women after they were found by police. No one knew. No one would say. That really disturbed me, and it was one of the reasons for applying for funding to do the study on Canada's role in human trafficking. A lot of the myths and misconceptions about trafficking that you see in the movies and in TV shows, we didn't know if any of this was even happening in Canada or what it looked like. Every country around the world has some involvement in human trafficking. We know that from studies that have been done. But to what extent does it happen in Canada, and how and where? No one really knew. Very anecdotal information. So you cannot help people with that kind of knowledge base. So what we did is we founded a group here called the Human Trafficking Working Group. And I also have a few research assistants who help coordinate that group with me. And what the project has been involving since September of 07 rather, has been documenting known cases. So we don't just look at anecdotal accounts, we look at actual evidence and use everything from immigration decisions, criminal court decisions, newspaper reports. We do interviews. I've done about 50 interviews across the country with police, immigration officers, social workers, government policy advisors, and then on top of that, we filed about 50 or 60 accessed information requests to the federal and provincial governments in Canada to get into the confidential government databases, and then they release us information which we've been able to make very good use of. We're almost done the research for this study and are starting to write it up, and our findings have surprised us even. We kept an open mind. One of the students in the first week or two of our working group getting started was listening to me describe internationally how this problem works. I said, you know, there are several ways a country can be involved in human trafficking. One's as a destination country. People are brought here and exploited from abroad. Then there's the transit problem, where people are brought through Canada or another country and onto a third country where they're exploited. And then there's this phenomenon of the country being a source country, meaning their own citizens are victims. And at the time,
all anyone had ever heard about was the possibility of Canada being a destination and transit country. No one had ever talked about Canada being a source country, meaning that they're actually Canadian victims. So I said, well, of course, we'll be focusing on the destination and transit problem. And the student raised her hand and said, well, if no one studied it, then why shouldn't we at least check? And I said, oh, okay, you know, yeah, you're right, you're right. I said, but we're not going to put too many people on that, right? We'll just, we have 12 people, let's put two on that and four on the other two and a few others to work on some other problems. Sure enough, though, over the course of our research, we began uncovering increasing amounts of evidence that Canadian victims were being targeted. By this summer, so about a year into our research, we saw the first conviction for human trafficking in Canada under the Criminal Code, this new crime which has only been on the books since November of 2005. And sure enough, the victims were Canadian and the offenders were Canadian. Since then, there have been two more convictions. All of them have involved domestic sex trafficking, Canadian girls. So students have a lot to say, not just in terms of the research objectives and how we go about it, but also in helping to generate our findings. At this point, the working group has been active for a year and a half now. We've involved an interdisciplinary group from computer science that have helped us develop a case database that's a fantastic tool, which is involving some mapping software now to help us trace some routes and identify cities where this is taking place. And we've begun to piece together the puzzle of why Canada has been so slow to respond, because our record in dealing with this has really lagged behind other countries around the world.
Listening to Prof Talk on CITR 101.9 FM. If you would like to send feedback of this show, please email us at proftalk@gmail.com or visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. You can also hear the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. I am Farha Khan. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye for now.
Night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pick my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.